You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting on commercial stations from coast to coast, on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations all across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio on every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as television on both Dish Network and DirecTV and several hundred cable systems nationwide via the Free Speech TV Network. Welcome back to our program, or welcome to our program for the day. Super Tuesday today! And Ohio is the epicenter. So let's check in with our old friend Cliff Schechter, the national progressive PR strategist, nationally syndicated columnist for Al Jazeera English, and the head of LibertasLLC.com, who lives in Ohio. Hey, Cliff.
Hey, Tom. How are you, man?
Just great. Great to have you with us. So, I'm looking at this one particular news story. This was actually from a couple of days ago, but it is instructive of today. It says, despite the vast territory in play across the country, from Alaska to Idaho to Vermont, Virginia, and Georgia, Romney will sleep in Ohio every night until Tuesday. And then on top of that, apparently Romney's spending about $3.8 million between him and his PAC on radio advertising in Ohio. Mostly television advertising, actually, radio and TV media, but mostly TV and radio in Ohio. And Rick Santorum's only going to spend about $500,000, maybe $600,000. And yet Santorum and Romney are in a dead heat. What's going on in Ohio? What's the media landscape like? Are you being blanketed by negative ads, positive ads? What approaches these people take? What's going on?
Well, I'm sure Romney and his super PAC aren't coordinating, of course, to begin with, Tom. So let's get that straight up.
Yeah, super PAC is only run by his old buddy, and, you know, yeah.
Couldn't help but start with sarcasm. Yeah, we're being blanketed, particularly here in Columbus, which is kind of a swing area. I mean, it's trending, you know, well, I mean, it doesn't really matter in general election terms. It's trending more to the left these days. But you'd think that would help Romney, who, even though he's trying to be to the right of Santorum, that's a pretty tough place to occupy, short of becoming Francisco Franco or something of that sort. And so, you know, it is very close. Every poll has it within a couple of points. Marist has, you know, had Romney up by two. Or, I'm sorry, Santorum up by two. One of the other ones the other day, I can't think of which one, had the opposite result. They're definitely both in the 30s, very close. I think, again, Romney, the problem here is the same problem he had in Michigan. Santorum opened his mouth, of course, on issues like birth control and talking about how much he wanted to vomit when hearing John F. Kennedy speak, which didn't help him there, doesn't help him here. I think he still benefits from the view from many, you know, Ohio is still a heavily working class, older, white state, and it benefits from Romney looking as out of touch as he is, you know, and Romney just making that recent remark that they're not wealthy or she doesn't feel like they're wealthy. Right. It's just, in a long line of statements like that. When it comes to, when people here see Mitt Romney, the white working class, they tend to see someone who's coming to, you know, come after their Social Security benefits, Medicare, other things that are very, very important to them. And I think that's still, the perception's still there.
Santorum, they don't realize that Santorum wants to do the same thing?
He does, and it's not, I think it's more about perception. Yeah. It's more that Santorum, at least at some points during this campaign, has been smart enough to tell the story of his grandfather, the coal miner who came from Italy, and Romney doesn't have a story like that he can
tell. Well, he can tell a story about his grandfather who came from Mexico because he had to flee to Mexico because he had four wives.
And that, as you can imagine, is a very popular story in Ohio. that does great in those
areas. His great-grandfather had to flee there because he had 13 wives or something like that, yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, of course. And he only started on that when he realized he had nothing, you know, I don't know why it took him so long, he had nothing in common with regular people and had to try to pretend that he did. So I'm not saying, look, all these guys have unbelievably right-wing corporatist agendas. It's just Mitt Romney seems to be the least comfortable trying connecting at all with regular people, and that, to me, is why Santorum is doing as well as he's doing, because a lot of people feel like he's one of them, even if you and I know that he's not.
Yeah. The thing that I'm really curious about, Cliff, and you can give us a unique insight into this. I've lived in early primary states. Louise and I used to live in New Hampshire, and I've lived in states that whose primaries are inconsequential by and large. Back in the day, Georgia, Michigan, and Oregon, and you know, there's a world of difference in the media landscape, and I'm just curious what kinds of, you know, I know that they're doing saturation advertising on television right now. You're there in Columbus, Ohio,
right?
You know, historically, what Romney has done, and he did it very effectively against Newt Gingrich, is basically take down his opponents with slasher ads, or at least his super PACs did, and then build up his own, and then have his own campaign build up his image as somebody who would never think of putting a dog on the roof of his car for 13 hours.
Of course.
What kind of ads are being run there in Ohio?
Well, you know, yeah, he's got some positive ones he's running, but of course the slasher ads are here too. I mean, it's an old formula that even has gotten worse post Citizens United, which is, you know, have more money than your opponent and spend enough ads to destroy them, and then you win by default. And of course, his PAC is still, Super PAC is still doing the, here, you mentioned the numbers, those negative ads and mailers and, you know, radio ads are everywhere. Obviously, you know, right now Mitt Romney is the most unpopular potential major party candidate, I think, since Bob Dole, maybe more so. So, yeah, it's also hurting him. And in the general election, again, this is a key general election state, as everybody knows. And so he's trading in the short run for the long run. And in the long run, I think I saw a poll the other day. He was behind Obama by 7 points here, which is unbelievable when you think of the current state of the economy. While improving, it's still rougher out here. And so he's hurting himself.
Kasich turned down all that federal money for high-speed rail, and so the, you know, Ohio lost the potential of another 20, 30,000 jobs. He just turned down, you know, tornado money, although I guess he's reconsidering that, which is, you know, more jobs.
Sure.
It looks like Kasich is doing the dance. I mean, you know, he got $1.25 million from Fox News for his campaign that made him governor. And a couple hundred thousand from the Koch brothers. So it looks like he's doing the dance that Roger Ailes and the Koch brothers want him to do. I'm curious here. This is a clip five here, Jacob. This is Rush Limbaugh over the last couple of days, you know, basically drowning in this particular soup. And I want to ask you a question about this. Here, listen to this clip.
So, Ms. Fluke, and the rest of you feminazis, here's the deal. If we are going to pay for your contraceptives and thus pay for you to have sex, we want something for it. And I'll tell you what it is. We want you to post the videos online so we can all watch.
Now, you know, that sounds so perverted. I can't come up with another word. I mean, it sounds like an old pervert saying, "Hey, I want to see you naked." I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, that Limbaugh has been, you know, he certainly always pushes Republicans, that he's been recently kind of pushing Romney, or at least defending him. Are Limbaugh's problems playing any role in the politics of the primaries?
It is, because it's forcing this discussion in there. I mean, these guys don't want to go anywhere near this discussion. And again, even here in Ohio, you know, and some of the suburban women that, you know, who are Republicans, I can only imagine the result, you know, what people are thinking. Again, with Rush Limbaugh making that statement, which I think was, out of everything, possibly the most ridiculous of them, although he made a whole
and he said it
them.
Several times, by the way. I've got other clips of him saying essentially the same
thing. Well, sex is about his pleasure, not a woman's pleasure, and I think that goes into behind the attitudes of a lot of these guys and why they're doing this, and I think it reminds a lot of women of you know, the way things were in the past. Mm-hmm. And there's no doubt, I mean, look, if every day Romney has to sort of, you know, talk about Limbaugh, talk about birth control, you know, and Rick Santorum stupid enough to open his mouth on that voluntarily, are days when they're just going to lose votes. 99% of women use birth control, 98% of Catholic women. This is not an issue like abortion or something where they may have some room to, you know, appeal to conservatives. They're offending almost everybody with this. And so, yeah, I think it is playing a role here. Again, you know, it's putting them into this box. They've boxed themselves in on economic issues, again, by going after Social Security, going after Medicare, saying they want to cut taxes for corporations in the top 1%, issues that don't play well in an economically populist area like Ohio. And Ohio is a little more socially conservative than some of the, particularly some East Coast and West Coast states, but they found a way to go well to the right in Ohio, and I'm guessing in some of the other states that are having primaries today. They've done the same thing. They've gone well to the right of where even Republican women are.
Amazing.
It's such a stupid thing to talk about and to bring up, and they've allowed Rush Limbaugh essentially to own them on this one, and they're going to pay the price.
There you go. Cliff Schechter, thanks so much.
Thank you, Tom.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's a remarkable thing to watch, the Republican Party imploding. Here's the question. Will billions be able to save them in November? I'm concerned.
Your campaign could end up with a win or a lose day. Tuesday, Tuesday. Well, the super dates in over 20 states with delegate rules of their own. In the Republican brawl, some are winner take all, and some are proposed. abortion prone.
But welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. The True People's Media, the Tom Hartman radio and TV program. Super Tuesday has arrived. It is today. 419 delegates, 11 states up for grabs. And Mitt Romney looks like he's probably going to win four primaries. It's probably going to be, this is probably going to be the beginning of the end of Santorum and Gingrich. Gingrich is camped out down in Georgia. He's trying to hang on to that. He doesn't want to have it a horrible embarrassment by losing his own home state. Santorum is fighting for Ohio, but he's only got, you know, his billionaire has only come up with $600,000. And Romney's billionaires have come up with so far about $4 million just to spend in Ohio, and just to spend across the Super Tuesday states. And even at that, President Obama is now polling above 50%, which could forecast a landslide victory. New NBC Wall Street Journal poll: 40% say the primary process has hurt the Republicans, created a bad image of the Republican Party, hurting the brand. And by a margin of 46-41%, Americans want to give Congress, the House and the Senate, back to Democrats. I find this really interesting, and I think it's because their party has basically only been looking out for the misogynists, the millionaires, the billionaires. And Rush Limbaugh is the public face of it today. Right now, Rush Limbaugh is the public face of the Republican Party. And you know, to prove that he's trying to make this all partisan, clip number 9 here, Jacob. Here's Rush Limbaugh talking about his whole controversy being really about politics.
The point here is that this was an issue that represents a tiny, tiny slice of what the Democrats really want here. They used Sandra Fluck to create a controversy. Sandra Fluck used them to advance her agenda, which is to force a religious institution to abandon their principles in order to meet hers.
Right. And you know, then on top of that, he goes off with things like clip number 6 here, Jacob, if you have it.
So we're going to sit here, if we're going to have to pay for this, then we want something in return, Ms. Fluke, and that would be the videos of all this sex posted online so we can see.
Yeah, that just creeps me out. Clip number 7.
She can't afford her own birth control pills. Ms. Fluke, have you ever heard of not having sex? Have you ever heard of not having sex so often?
Now, I think most Americans by now have learned that she wasn't talking about herself. She wasn't talking about her sex life. Nobody even knows if she has a sex life. This wasn't about her and her sex life. This was about the medical needs of women that of a percentage of women, 14% is the statistic that is used most frequently. I believe it's an AMA statistic for, you know, the medical need for hormonal therapy, which comes in the form of pills that are often called birth control pills. But this misogyny that Rush is spilling out, is spewing out, it's just this is painting the entire Republican Party. To the point that clip number 10 here, Rush is now becoming the butt of incredible jokes. Stephen Colbert.
I don't think Rush should have apologized for calling her a prostitute. I mean, it takes one to know one. And remember, he only apologized to keep his advertisers, proving Rush will do anything with his mouth for cash.
Mm-hmm. So, meanwhile, back in the Mitt Romneyville, Mitt's wife now has joined her husband in the open mouth insert foot game. Here's Ann Romney.
We can be poor in spirit, and I don't look, and I don't even consider myself wealthy, which is an interesting thing. It can be here today and gone tomorrow.
Here today and gone tomorrow. I think if you've got $200-300 million in the bank, and you've got all these stock options that bring in $20-30 million a year at a 14% tax rate, 15% income tax rate, I think it's probably not going to be gone tomorrow. And you wonder how many people who have $400 million in the bank. Rush Limbaugh's net worth is estimated to be $300-400 million. How many people in that category, the Rush Limbaugh category, the Mitt Romney category, that level of wealth, actually feel that insecure? I find that astounding. And I think most Americans who are living day by day find that really astounding. So, anyway, we'll see where that goes. Meanwhile, students in California, last night, 68 patriots were arrested in Sacramento protesting the planned cuts to education. Did you know that in just in the last 5 years, the cost of going to one of the University of California public schools, the UC Berkeley, UCLA, on and on, what used to be free until Ronald Reagan became governor, and he spent virtually his entire governorship trying to destroy free education in California, and finally succeeded as he was leaving office and the governor who followed him, that what used to be free, over the last 5 years, the cost of education in California has doubled. And so there's a ballot initiative. It's going to be on the ballot in November that says that anybody making over $250,000 a year has to pay a small extra tax so that kids can go to college in California. And you had people doing a sit-in last night at the state capitol in Sacramento, and 68 of these patriots were arrested. This blows my mind. By the way, today is town meeting day in Vermont. Cities across over 50 cities in Vermont have on their ballots town meeting day. This is direct democracy. You show up, you raise your hand, you vote. Over 50 cities in Vermont are going to be voting on whether they should support a constitutional amendment to roll back Citizens United like their Senator Bernie Sanders has proposed. You can see that over at his website, sanders.senate.gov, and you can sign on for it. And you can go to bernie.org, his campaign website, for more information about Senator Sanders. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And speaking of Bernie, he got 70 senators to sign a letter to the Commodities Futures Trading Commission to stop the oil speculation that's jacking up gas prices. Interesting. Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here with big news. We're moving. Starting next week, the Tom Hartman Program will be live 3 to 6 p.m. Eastern Time. That's noon to 3 Pacific Time.
I'm your biggest ditto head. I say everything you've said. When you die, then I'll be dead. But I'll still listen. No one can stop me. When you talk, I get a rush. I tell everybody, shush. They all say I got a crush, like I'd have if you were atop me. Limbo, how low can you go? Limbo,
welcome back. I'm here with you, Talk Media for the sane among us. Cheesy news alert. Courtesy of Andy Borowitz, BorowitzReport.com. Embattled radio host Rush Limbaugh has suffered another major desertion today as he lost the support of one of his longtime sponsors, Satan. The usually reclusive Prince of Darkness announced his decision at a hastily called press conference in Columbus, Ohio, his unofficial headquarters on Earth. Satan said in a tersely worded statement, due to remarks of his that we consider unacceptable, we are terminating our relationship with Rush Limbaugh. According to one advisor to the Lord of Misrule, Satan had stuck by the radio host as long as possible, but after he called a young woman a slut on the air, Mr. Limbaugh became, quote, radioactive. Satan, the aide said, after a certain point, the association with Rush became problematic for Satan's public image. We went through a similar thing last year with Rupert Murdoch. Advertisers continued abandoning Mr. Limbaugh's program in droves today, including companies who had sponsored it for years, like the online dating site NaziMingle.com. The only good news for Mr. Limbaugh today came after GOP presidential candidate Mitt Romney, who offered this muted statement of support. Look, I wouldn't have chosen the words he did, but it's not like he called her a poor person or something. End of quote. No, Romney didn't actually say that. But here's something Ann Romney did say. Once again, the open foot, insert, you know, gold clad foot in mouth, gold shoe or whatever. She said, some people have lovers in every port. I have horses in every port. So she's got, you know, cars on both Cadillacs on both coasts. And apparently every place she goes, she has she's a horse enthusiast. So doesn't every horse enthusiast have a horse wherever they, you know, one in California, one in Boston, one in, you know, who knows? I guess so. 866-97-THOM, our telephone number. And Dwayne in Portland, listening on KPOJ. Hey, Dwayne, what's up?
Hello.
Hey, you're on the air, Dwayne. Yeah.
Yeah, hey, I was just talking about Rush Limbaugh.
Uh-huh.
I think everybody's skirting around the whole deal that his mind's starting to lose it on the OxyContin, you know?
You know, because, nobody has raised that, you know, is he back on drugs or not? Go ahead.
What I'm saying is, you know, like, I used to do drugs years ago and speed, and, you know, I used to just rap off like crazy, you know, and just to be talking, you know?
Yeah.
And you just can't shut them people up.
Yeah, well, Dwayne, thanks a lot for the call. I mean, you know, it's not inconceivable that his judgment has been marred by pharmaceuticals, and that's why he keeps pushing this thing. But who knows? I just, you know, I don't know him. I don't know what's going on inside his head. Dan in East Hartford, or in his body, in East Hartford, Connecticut. Hey, Dan, what's up?
Hello, Tom. Love your show. I was just calling in concern to Rick Santorum and how everybody wanted Santorum to become the candidate because he was so easily beatable and everything else. Mm-hmm. And what I think that does is dumbs down the national conversation. And I think we need to veer away from that whole thing, and Santorum has to just be put to rest.
You mean metaphorically? Politically.
Yes, of course.
Yes. Okay. I think that they're, just generally speaking, there's an incredible dumbing down of the political conversation. Thanks for the call, by the way, and thanks for watching us on Free Speech TV there in Connecticut. I think the whole thing is in the fact that it's all about, you know, these brief talking points, and we're not having substantive conversations in the political discourse in America. The politician, you have debates. I mean, during the Nixon Kennedy debates, Nixon and Kennedy actually talked for like 5 minutes each and said something of consequence. Sir, you have 30 seconds. Please answer in one word. You know, how do you describe yourself? Did you notice none of those guys said presidential? That surprised me. I kept waiting. You know, I thought, okay, Romney's going to nail this. He's going to say presidential. No, he blew it. So then, you know, it finally gets to Gingrich, and he's smart enough. He's got to say president. No, he's just cheerful. Candace in Salem, West Virginia. Hey, Candace, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you? Hey, I just wanted to say a quick hi, and also I saw Bernie Sanders this morning on Squawk on the Street on MSNBC.
Uh-huh.
And usually that's for the 1%, not the 99ers.
Yep.
And he gave about 10 minutes. And came out with a lot of information that you have escalated on your show as far as the oil, you know, bringing down the oil prices,
right,
and, you know, the market and everything else. So I just wanted to let you know that, you know, kudos to you. And
well,
thank you,
Candace, and kudos to Bernie.
Right.
Thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for watching us there in Salem, West Virginia, on Free Speech TV. Here's the thing. About 70% of all the oil right now in the United States, all the oil futures, all the oil can be bought on the market, you know, pushing out over the next year, is owned by the banks, who are never going to use it. But they've taken it off the market, which does what? It drives the price up. And not just oil products, including gasoline. And then the other thing is that the United States has become, for the first time in 62 years, a net exporter of petroleum products. We're exporting gasoline like there's no tomorrow. Why? Because when the oil companies export gasoline, it creates a shortage in the United States, which drives up the price. And they make more money. And you say, oh, that's terrible. That's unpatriotic. But their job is to make money. And it's our job to say, you know, no, you can't go that far. You can't get that crazy. You can't do that kind of thing. Jackie in Port Townsend, Washington. Hey, Jackie, and thanks for listening to AM 1090. What's up? Talk 1090.
Well, thanks for all you do. Number one, but as a result of a concerted community petition drive, I just wanted to tell you that last night the city of Port Townsend passed a resolution supporting the Move to Amend campaign to call for an amendment to the Constitution to abolish corporate personhood.
Great. Congratulations. That's great news. Step by step, all across the country, we're seeing these, you know, in cities that, you know, for years I've been saying, please get like instant runoff voting and things like that. And you know, this stuff that was like you'd think was low hanging fruit. And then I've been talking about corporate personhood since I wrote the book on it in 2001, Unequal Protection. And nobody understood it until Citizens United came along. And now, like, there's this nationwide movement mobilizing, and that is so great. That's so great. Thank you, Jackie. Mark Taylor Canfield in Seattle has an update on Occupy protests. What's going on, Mark? You were on BBC the other day, weren't you?
Yes, there was a discussion, an international dialogue about the protests in Russia against Putin. Mm. And I pretty much told them that, you know, the occupiers, although I can't speak for all of them, of course, but most of them are saying, you know, that they stand in solidarity with the protesters there. And the photos coming out of Moscow are reminding me a little bit of some of the pictures I saw in Oakland or New York City or even Seattle during some of the Occupy protests.
Yeah, and luckily, some of the voting stuff reminds me of Ohio in 2004. But in any case, Mark, the Occupy protests here, but you have an update.
Yeah, well, here in Seattle, I mean, there have been conferences and protests and rallies going on every week, so it's actually really hard to keep up with it all. So any rumors about the death of the Occupy movement are highly exaggerated, to quote Mark Twain. But folks have marched against a proposed toxic incinerator plan, and they've rallied with labor unions. And this last week, teachers and students marched on the Gates Foundation on a national day calling for more funding for education.
Yeah.
So people are really busy.
Good.
I wanted to give you a heads up about some mass protests that are being planned for May. On May 1st, the traditional day for workers' rights, there are Occupy groups all over the country that are calling for protests on that day for workers, including some general strikes. I know that they're calling for that in Oakland. And then we just found out today, that the G8 summit, which was scheduled for Chicago in May, which was going to be a major convergence for a lot of protesters, has now been moved by President Obama to Camp David. So
yeah.
I guess they're
I think
they're hoping to avoid 50,000 people heading to Chicago. But
yeah, I was waiting for that. I was waiting for that to happen. Mark, thanks a lot for the update. I appreciate it. Dan in Stockton, California. Dan, we have a minute to the break. You were at Sacramento last night.
Yes, I was. When I was there, there was a lot of police around. There's like one policeman for every three protesters or something like that.
Wow.
It's like they were really, really looking for trouble. And it's possible, I think, that there were some agents provocateur in the group.
Mm-hmm. And were you one of the 68 who got arrested?
No, of course not. No.
Was it a peaceful protest, or were there people, you say agents provocateurs, were there people who were throwing things, or I mean, what was happening?
I don't know what happened inside the Capitol building. I never did go in.
Oh, that's where the arrests happened, inside?
I'm presuming so, because there was the sit-in, you know.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Great. Dan, thank you very much for the update and for calling in. We'll be back in just a minute. It's 45. Coming up on 45 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. Stick around. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
By the way, it's not just the banksters who are holding 70% of the oil in hostage. They're also putting this stuff on tankers and moving it offshore.
I mean, I have the right to vote, so I have a say. But that doesn't mean I always get my way. All we can do is make sure we're heard. Never roll over, keep spreading the word. We're standing tall even as our name is burned.
Welcome back to the place where despair is not an option. Get out there, get active. Let's take over the politics of America. You know, the Tea Party, they made a good try, and they just about, well, arguably did. I mean, you know, they paralyzed the House of Representatives for almost 2 years now. Pat, I think it's time for progressives to do the same. Pat, as we have in the past, and as we did in the 30s, as we did in the 19-teens. Pat in Port Huron, Michigan, listening on WDTW. Hey, Pat, what's up?
Hi, Tom. You know, with this thing going on with Limbaugh and all the other baloney that goes on, people say both sides do it, you know? And I am so sick of hearing that and then the others, and because we don't, not to the extent that they do it.
No.
And then we settle into that argument to where we're on the defense of, you know?
It's the false equivalency, Pat. The media is always looking for a false equivalency. And so they'll get on, for example, oh, well, let's talk about global warming. Well, 99.9% of all the scientists on Earth and every developed nation except the United States has totally signed off on the fact that global warming is happening. Global warming is destructive. The insurance companies all understand it. Everybody understands it, except for places like, you know, the Heartland Institute funded by the Koch brothers. And so the media says, well, you know, you've got 99% on one side saying, yes, of course this is happening. And you've got a loud 1% who are funded by the oil industry saying, no, no, it's not happening. So let's have them on for a debate as if it was a 50-50 issue. They used to do the same thing back 15 years ago about whether tobacco is addictive and causes cancer. You know, before that, it was asbestos. It is a phony false equivalency. And it's tragic that the media plays that game. Back to you.
Yeah. Also, that my money, you know, when they're talking about the taxes, like in this this young lady that's being crucified over birth control, you know,
right,
where people say, you know, I don't want my money going there, you know, it's just false, you know. It's my money, too. It's everybody's money. It's taxes.
Well, no, it's not, actually, and that's one of the big lies. It is what we're talking about here. Is health insurance, the universities require their students to have health insurance, and the universities offer that health insurance.
It has nothing to do with what people are paying in taxes.
That's right. You have
to. It's going to be private insurance and what somebody buys and puts in their insurance plan.
That's right. And you have to, as a student, you have to buy. Thank you very much, Pat. As a student, you have to buy that insurance. And Eileen in San Antonio, Texas. Hey, Eileen. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Hi, Tom. I'm calling about that Citizens United.
Yeah.
And Ralph Nader sent out a petition quite a while ago that I signed to make sure they got rid of Citizens United because it destroys democracy.
Mm-hmm.
Everything that they're doing right now is just, you know, like the Rush Limbaugh thing is just, you know, to me it means nothing. You know,
the country has become a kleptocracy, a plutocracy. We're being run by plutocrats and, you know, by plutocrat right wing, by and large, billionaires. And in fact, right wing exclusively billionaires. And the consequence of this is that democracy is dying. The middle class is dying. And they want to divert our attention away from their economic agenda. And that's why they go on these rants about birth control and sex.
Exactly.
Yeah,
because they know it'll enrage people, and what they're trying to do is they use methods of triggering your anger. You know what I mean? Instead of focusing on what's important.
Oh yeah, it is
real health care issues, real energy, sustainable energy. You know, all that energy, all that nuclear stuff leaks into all our water tables and destroys so many people's lives. Talk about, you know, terrorism.
Yeah,
that's
it's an absolute divert people away from the real issues.
Yeah.
And let's talk about irrelevant things. And in the case of Limbaugh, thank you very much, Eileen. In the case of Limbaugh, it's even, let's talk about a lie that Sandra Fluck is asking for taxpayers to pay for contraception when it wasn't even part of the conversation. And all of this because Daryl Issa held hearings on this issue and refused to allow any women to testify. Because, of course, only men know about religious liberty or women's reproductive issues, right? Only middle-aged white guys know. It's incredible. John in Florissant, Colorado. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, Tom. You're great.
Thank you.
I used to be in radio for a while, and I just really get off on your show.
Thank you.
Anyway, I wanted you to this Rush Limbaugh thing. He was married for four times, and
right,
he still doesn't understand women's health issues as it applies to birth control.
He seems to think that the more times you have sex, the more times you need to take pills. I'm guessing that he thinks that because if he actually is a Viagra user and if a man needs Viagra to be able to have sex, then sure enough, the more times he has sex, the more times he has to take a pill. And so maybe he assumes that it works the same way with birth control pills for women. I don't know, but it certainly sounds that way because that's basically what he's said.
He's just not paying attention. I really wanted to talk about, do we know about his handlers? Do we know how his show is set up? Do we know who, is his show written for him? Does
no.
he just arrive at work and he's got a big pile and he just rattled?
No, there was actually a pretty good profile of Rush that was written. I think it was in the New York Times Sunday Magazine. It was in one of the more thoughtful publications, maybe 2 years ago, where the reporter spent several days with him at his mansion down in Palm Beach, or Palm Springs, or whatever the Palm is down there in Florida. I'm confused, Florida and California. You know, he gets up in the morning, he reads the papers, he comes up with what he thinks is going to be a good show. He talks it over with his producer. His producer pulls together the clips. It's pretty much the same thing that Louise and I do. We do this. Jacob goes through the stories. Paul, Jim, they look at the news stories. We all talk about them, and Jacob pulls together the clips, and boom, you've got a show. I mean, it's not like he's got, you know, 25 writers who are working with him. I think it's a pretty straightforward. Talk radio is typically a pretty straightforward operation, and it lives or dies based on the host's ability to take the news and synthesize it with a consistent and easily communicated opinion, and then, you know, bring people like yourself, John, in to have a conversation with. So, John, thank you for the call. I don't think that his handlers have any control over him.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Charles Murray, the W.H. Brady Scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, AEI.org, and author of several books, including co-author of the very controversial The Bell Curve, is back into print with a brand new book. It's called Coming Apart, The State of White America, 1960 to 2010, a book that I consider to be an absolutely searing indictment of Reaganomics and libertarian economics. Charles Murray, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom.
You have done a marvelous job of showing what has happened as a consequence of right to work for less laws, of Bill Clinton ending welfare as we know it, the consequences that have come from that. How can anybody, after they've looked at your research, continue to support libertarianism or the Republican Party's attacks on things like, you know, for example, Paul Ryan's plan to voucherize Medicare?
Well, you got part of it right, which is that I presented a very detailed description of a problem, and what I did not do deliberately was spend a lot of time on causes, and I'll tell you why. I have an incredibly different view than you do.
Well, actually, you do. You blame it mostly on the poor people and on the '60s. I got that.
No, actually, if you look at the book, I didn't.
I've read much of the book.
No. What I carefully did was not go through the arguments in Losing Ground. And the reason I didn't go through the arguments in Losing Ground was because I want to make the book one that someone on the left can read without throwing against the wall. There are no cheap shots against the left. There is no diatribe against Lyndon Johnson. There is an attempt here to try to describe a problem, and then I begin part three by saying people on the left can have reached this point in the book and think I have made a compelling case for redistributionist policies and an advanced welfare state. People on the right can think that I've made another compelling case for programs to support marriage and traditional values. Libertarians can think I've made a compelling case for limited government. I'm interested in focusing on the problem in this book.
But your point, for example, page 241, I'm looking at it right now.
Which is chapter what?
The Selective Collapse of American Community.
Yep.
And you've got some great statistics here. The number of people who voted in presidential elections, down 22% from 1960 to 1996.
Mm-hmm.
Attended public meeting in town or school affairs, down 35% from 73 to 94. Became an officer of a social club or organization, down 42% from 73 to 94. I mean, those, and this long list here, those were the kind of things I remember my parents doing in the 50s and 60s and 70s. You know, my mom was a volunteer to what is it when you show up to help people vote, you know, and you take to register vote, you know, sit there at the at the school and sign people in, and my dad and mom were on the PTA and all that kind of stuff. I mean, they were very much part of the community. And it was because My dad worked in a tool and die shop and had a good, solid union job that he worked at for 40 years and was able to pay off his house and buy a new car every 3 years and raise four kids and have that middle-class dream. That was at a time, you know, when Ronald Reagan came into office. And a lot of your statistics start in the 60s, which surprises me because you could just as easily have started in the late 70s, early 80s. Because when Ronald Reagan came into office, a quarter of America was unionized and had that, and therefore half of America had that lifestyle that my dad did. And now, here after 30 years, 31 years of Reaganomics, of war on working people by the Republican Party, the Libertarians, and the Conservatives, you're down to 7% of the American populace in the private workforce being unionized and having that kind of security and stability that my parents had that allows one person to work in the family, that allows them to participate in politics, that gives them the time to go out there and do the things that you're talking about. And you make the case in the book that the reason why this unraveling is happening, or at least my take on your take, was that the reason this is unraveling is because people are not getting married when they're having babies and because people aren't going to church as often and because people's moral values are crumbling. And I would say that those are all the consequence of the 30-year war on working people that's been launched by Ronald Reagan and waged by conservatives and libertarians, and that you're confusing cause with effect.
But why did these trends start then in the 1960s instead of the 1980s?
Well, if you look at the trend lines, actually they really picked up steam in the 1980s, not the 1960s.
Well, some of them do, some of them don't. You had, for example, marriage started to collapse really fast in the 1970s.
Yeah, and I would submit that that was probably the consequence of the birth control pill, of the sexual revolution. And that collapse of marriage didn't, I think if you look at the numbers, that doesn't exactly correlate with the other social ills that you're talking about. Those correlate more directly with economics than with marriage.
Well, why is it then that first a couple of just real simple facts that you can, you know, pull down from the internet. If you go to the 1960 census and take the variable called earned income, and if you take all the occupations that qualify as blue-collar occupations and working-class occupations, and ask the computer to give you the average earned income in real dollars, concurrent dollars from 1960, and do the same thing for 2005, 2008, 2010, whenever, you are not going to see that there was this wonderful family wage in 1960 that we don't have now. In fact, the numbers for the average wage for those occupations has gone up not much.
Well, actually, I would submit to you that there's two things you're missing there. First of all, you're only using earned income, and you're not looking at unearned income like the way that Mitt Romney lives, or the way that Paris Hilton lives.
No, I'm talking about
those,
working class.
Those,
Tom, let me at least make the point, okay?
Finish your point, then. I thought you had.
That your dad, the tool and die maker, okay, you aggregate all the people who worked in the kinds of jobs he worked in, working class jobs. I am saying that if there was a family wage in 1960, there is a family wage in 2010 because in real value, that dollar figure did not go down. You can argue that it should have gone up, but you can't argue that it's gone down.
If it hasn't gone down, inflation has gone up.
No. I'm talking about real purchasing power.
Okay. Then
constant dollars.
I don't think that anybody's buying that. And here's the simple thing that I would suggest that you look at, Charles Murray, and that is take productivity and earned income, productivity and wages, those two variables, and look at them from 1900 to 2011. And what you will see is that is that productivity and wages tracked each other within a single percent point from 1900 until 1980. And at that point,
you're making an argument that wages should have gone up and they didn't.
At that point, when Reagan started his war on working people, wages flattened out, productivity increased, and what comes out of productivity? Profits. And so all that money, you've seen a 275% increase in the money that went to the top 1% and the bottom 99%, bupkis.
That case you can't make.
I just did.
No, you made a case that wages should have gone up, given productivity gains, and they didn't. That's an interesting point.
They didn't since 1980. Not since 1960.
Could somebody support a family in 1960 on the average earned income for a working class job, and they can't do it in 2010? That just is not true.
Well, I guess we have dueling statistics here and memories of that era. But setting that, well, I guess we'll have to set that aside because we're not going to resolve that. But the core issue of your book, how would you describe the core issue coming apart?
That we have developed classes that are different in kind from anything that the American society has ever known. And economic inequality is not the worst part of it. The worst part of it is that we have had a civic culture, which has now been changed so that you have a new upper class that's increasingly isolated from and ignorant of mainstream society, and they run the country. And we have a new lower class, which is no longer participating in the core institutions that make vital communities possible. Now, that these are both new phenomena.
Yeah, and I don't disagree with that. We point to different causes for it, but I
don't deal with causes.
Yeah, okay. Well, I do. And I blame Reaganomics for it. But anyhow, Charles Murray, you can read all about it over at the AEI.org. And, of course, the book is Coming Apart, The State of White America, 1960 to 2010. Charles Murray, thanks for being with us today.
You're welcome.
Good talking with you. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
How do we bring back a middle class in the United States? Has it really vanished? Is Charles Murray right? It hasn't? Interesting. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Bob in Great Falls, Montana. Hey, Bob, what's on your mind?
Just a brief comment. It's been bothering me all morning when I heard the news about Secret Service going to protect Newt Gingrich. And I haven't researched this at all, but I really feel that the taxpayers shouldn't be paying for Secret Service for him. You know, he should use his super PAC or his buddy in Nevada to provide security for him.
Well, these are the rules that we've set up, is that if you're a serious presidential candidate and you're a very, very high profile person in the political realm, which has become very, very polarized and dangerous. There have been a number of political candidates over the years. The most recent high-profile, horrible one as a candidate was Bobby Kennedy when he was running for president. Gabby Giffords is the most recent, you know, attempted murder. Then you deserve some sort of protection from your government if you're going to be part of the government. In my opinion, I agree with providing Newt Gingrich with Secret Service protection. So, Yolanda in San Bernardino, California. Hey, Yolanda, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Good. What's on your mind? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV, by the way. What's up?
Well, thank you for providing us with such information that helps people like me out in San Bernardino. I'm poor, San Bernardino, really poor. I don't know all these statistics. I listen to it, but, you know, I'm living it. And mm-hmm. I'll tell you, right now my family's living on my Social Security check. And I have, two sons, one that just turned 18, one that's married and expecting his first baby, and it's really hard to live this way.
Yeah.
And I have it better than a lot of people because I have subsidized housing, and I look around and in my area here, it's pretty bleak.
Yeah.
And for instance, the subsidized housing program that I'm on, like, they just got through tripling my rent, and I don't know what I'm going to do for any extra money this month for sure. You know, as it was, we didn't have any extra money.
Yeah.
You know, and if you can imagine, and like I said, and there was one 4th of July a couple years ago when my kids called me at a friend's house and said, Mom, the only people on her block that have enough money for fireworks are people from Mexico. Mm-hmm. You know, the people that had jobs were the... You know, and I'm Hispanic, and my sons are half white, half, you know, Hispanic, and, you know, this is what's going on in our neighborhood. And I grew up like much like you, you know, very middle class, and, mm-hmm. you know, my mom and dad both had jobs. My mom was a Mexican cook, and my dad was a cement mason and construction worker, and you know.
And that was back in the days when you could actually raise a family doing labor. It suddenly occurred to me as I got off the air with Charles Murray that I can't say that he is or isn't, but using household versus individual statistics. But what I do know is that household income today is not radically different than it was in 1960. And 1960 probably wasn't the very best year to use because there was a recession in 1960 or right around that time. But throughout the 60s, from the end of World War II until today, household income hasn't gone up that much or hasn't fallen that much. But what has happened is that it now takes two people in the household to maintain that income. And so if you talk about individual income, what you see is that it has flattened out and productivity and inflation have left it in the dust since the Reagan administration.
I think I agree with all that stuff, but I wanted to tell you something, Tom, about something that I don't know if much of America is aware of. I'm sure some people are, but there's a lot of people like me who grew up as ADHD. I have Tourette's syndrome and, I don't have really overt tics that people can tell, but I had all the behavior problems all my life and no one knew. I was never diagnosed. So there's a lot of people I've seen with problems like me who were the people that fall through the cracks, right?
Yeah.
And so I've been doing everything to keep my head above water all these years, and I've been real resourceful about it and stuff. But let me tell you, I know I'm not the typical person, and I just feel sorry for a lot of people who I look around and see how people are drowning,
Yeah, no, it is tough all over. Yolanda, thank you very much for calling and sharing your story with us. I appreciate it. Shannon in Yucapaya, is that right?
It's Yucapa.
Okay. You can say it.
Okay,
I can't. What's up?
That's okay. I think it's an Indian name. I just wanted to say that I agreed with you, and you're speaking to the older gentleman, because I was first married in the 1960s, yeah. Mm. And we bought a house for $10,000. Our payment was like $165 a month, and that was on a 10-year contract. I was able to stay home with our children. I can remember even in the late 1950s when we got married, we had made perhaps $400 a month, but actually our rent was a quarter of that, and we had enough to pay our rent, to buy food,
yep.
And I was still able to stay home. So I really disagree with, I don't know much about statistics,
yeah.
But I know what the lady was saying just before me, because I'm disabled, I broke my back, okay. And if it weren't that I didn't have my daughter's family, I don't know what I would do.
Yeah.
And I watch a lot of little people around me that are in even worse shape. So.
I think people get it, generally speaking, regardless of what the experts from the right-wing think tanks say. I think that the average American understands, and this is what birthed the Tea Party, and it's also what's birthed the Occupy Wall Street movement. The average American understands that in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, before Reagan, students didn't have to go into debt that's going to take them 30 years to pay off to get through school. And one person could put a family through, through life, could raise a family in a household. And that ain't the case
now. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Has our government become too big to function? Janet has some thoughts. We'll ask her right after this. Hey, friends. Tom Hartman here with big news. We're moving. Starting next week, the Tom Hartman Program will be live 3 to 6 p.m. Eastern Time. That's noon to 3 Pacific Time.
Hard times everywhere I go.
Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. And oh, it's a Higgins alert. Higgins, our crazed cat who attacks everybody. An Oakland County, Michigan woman says she's become a prisoner in her own property, stalked and harassed by a 25-pound turkey. The bird, which Edna Geisler names Godzilla, wanders through her property and keeps her locked up in her house. She says she has to get up at 6 in the morning to go to the post office to avoid this giant bird. Well, we had, when Louise and I first moved onto a floating house in Portland, into a floating home, we had on our back dock, we didn't know that the dock next door had a female goose that was sitting on an egg. And so on our dock, the male goose was like protecting the territory. His name is Goose. We named him Goosellini. To walk out of the house, we had to carry a broom to hold him off because he would, geese can be really strong. And Higgins, our cat, really wanted to mix it up with Guccellini. Higgins is our cat who, like, takes out people when they come to visit our house. One time a plumber was working on the sink, and Louise literally caught Higgins in midair at about 5 feet up there. He'd climbed up on the refrigerator, flying off the refrigerator at this guy's head. He was going to land on this guy's head as he was, you know, crouching down to get underneath the sink. It was amazing. So anyhow, if you're watching us on TV right now, on the screen, there was a picture of Higgins and Guccellini going at it through a screen door on the back of our old house in Portland. Oh, my. Jim in Kinsman, Ohio. Hey, Jim, what's on your mind today?
Well, Tom, I had an idea, and it may be actually, I thought it was a pretty good idea. It's called a military surcharge, and it will tax. It will be imposed on multinational corporations, and it will be predicated, the percentage of the surcharge will be predicated on how much tax, what percentage of your tax burden you pay in the United States.
Well, you know, if the argument that you're making is that we protect the shipping lanes from Asia to the United States from pirates, and we protect the shipping lanes so that for goods manufactured over there for the transnational corporations, the, you know, Apple, Hewlett Packard, whatnot, that want to bring their computers in from Asia, and we protect with our military and thus our tax dollars the shipping lanes from the Middle East to the United States for oil, that the oil companies and that the technology companies and manufacturing companies should be paying some part of that military bill. Is that the essence of your argument?
Essentially, correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. And you're trying to accomplish a way to extract money from those companies to pay for it. Historically, and by historically, I literally mean that from 1793, right? The fifth year of the George Washington administration. No, wait a minute. It was 1789 when it started. So that would have been the fourth year of the George Washington administration until basically the Reagan administration. The Reagan administration began cutting away at this, and then George Herbert Walker Bush a little more, and then Bill Clinton a little more, and then George W. Bush, you know, totally. We did that. We called them import tariffs. They averaged from the period of George Washington's administration until Ronald Reagan's administration around 30-35%. We taxed everything that got imported into the United States with this import tax, and that import tax paid for, from the time of the George Washington administration until the Abraham Lincoln administration, 100% of the cost of the military, 100% of the cost of the entire federal government, the salaries of the president, the congressmen, the senators, everybody. It paid for everything. From the time of the Civil War until World War I, which is a period of incredible growth in the United States, that import tax, that called a tariff, those import tariffs, paid for two-thirds of the cost of the federal government. And from the time of World War I till World War II, it paid for fully a third of the federal government. The government, of course, expanded dramatically during that period of time, and as a result of the New Deal and the Great Depression and all that. And then from World War II until Reagan, it paid for a little less than a third. And now it only pays for, I think it's 1.5%, something like that. It's very, very tiny percentage. And so there is a way to go back to that, just to say, hey, you know, if you're going to manufacture things overseas and you want the military to protect you bringing them back here, and you want us to provide you with a marketplace and, you know, educated consumers who have enough money in their pocket to buy your products, then you get to pay a tax when they get imported. There's an entire chapter about this. In fact, I opened the book, Rebooting the American Dream, about this, how George Washington, when he was outstanding in his field, literally standing in his field, and one of his old general buddies from the Revolutionary War rides up and says, I think it was Henry Knox, says, General Washington, the Congress just met, you know, the Constitution's been ratified, Congress just met, and you have been elected President of the United States. It was in 1789, and you have 60 days or 30 days, no, I think it was 30 days, you got a relatively short period of time to get from here, Mount Vernon, to New York City, which was the seat of government. It's where, at that time, it's where George Washington got sworn in, right on Wall Street. You have, you know, this short period of time, and George Washington said, you know, he wanted to do two things. He wanted to visit his mother, who was dying, and she died. He never saw her again after that. And he did visit her. And he sent Henry Knox, is my recollection. In any case, it's in the book. He sent this guy, his Revolutionary War friend, up to Connecticut to the home of the one guy, or to the business of the one man in America who made fine clothing in the United States because it had been banned prior to the Revolutionary War by the British. And you had to import good fine clothing to buy a nice suit that he could be sworn into office. And he was sworn into office in an American-made suit, George Washington. And that's why he went to Alexander Hamilton and said, how do we get everything made in America? And Alexander Hamilton said, really simple, start charging import taxes on imported goods. It's how other countries do it. It's how England does it. This was put forward by King Henry II. It was called the Tudor Plan, like in 1450 or something like that. I mean, long ago. And the British copied it from the Dutch, who had been doing it since the 12th century, or the 13th century, the 1200s. And Washington put it in place, and it stood right up until Reagan, and it worked really well. So, Jim, thank you for the call and giving me an opportunity to rant about one of my favorite topics. We need to bring it back. We really do. Peter in Albuquerque, New Mexico, listening on AM 1350. Hey, Peter, what's up?
Well, we're driving down the road. I'm from Montana. My wife and I are snowbirding, so I heard two things on your show.
Mm-hmm.
One, bupkis. Are you a lawnsman?
I don't know what you're talking about.
You use the word bupkis.
Right. Which in my earlier years was a phrase that basically meant nothing.
Well, bupkis is part of my culture. I also heard
What's your culture? You said a something man? What was that?
Jewish. A landsman in the Jewish culture.
Oh, I see. Oh, bupkis. So it's Yiddish. Also, yeah, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, like Meshuggah.
Yeah.
Yiddish
was actually my first language, but that's a whole other story.
Well, you know what? If you can pass it along because it's dying, I'm doing that my grandchildren.
Yeah, it's dying everywhere except Mia Shireem.
No despair. There's a few more words attached to that.
Okay.
And despair is not an option. That's why I have a wife. I am blessed to have Neil deGrasse Tyson as a friend.
Mm-hmm.
And every now and then I ask him deep questions. And I said, what's wrong with the country? And he said, we lost the spirit of tomorrow that the space program essentially ignited. Oh, tomorrow we can do this. Tomorrow we can do that. And I think a lot of our spiritual malaise in the country is that people have lost that sense of tomorrow can be a better day.
Yeah, that John Kennedy, excellent point, Peter. Thank you for the call. And when John Kennedy said, we're going to send a man to the moon and bring him back within a decade, at that time, the technology did not exist. It wasn't like NASA was there and they were making rockets. It did not exist. I mean, he just pulled this out, as Newt Gingrich likes to point out, he just pulled this out of his head and said, this would be cool. Let's set a challenge. And it was brilliant. Jeff in North Providence, Rhode Island. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I really like this program, even though I am on the libertarian right. But let me offer my observations about what you discussed earlier about productivity and wages.
Yes, sir.
I'm an engineer by profession. I have a degree in electrical engineering, and I've looked at the I've worked in manufacturing all my life. I'm in my 50s right now. And if you look at the productivity from the turn of the 19th to the 20th century to up to now, we should be having essentially a 28-hour work week. If you look at the changes technologically, we've gone from using water power to electric motors to using polyphase AC to using what are called programmable logic controllers and robotics and automation,
right,
and so forth and so on. Six Sigma manufacturing, all of that should have added up to a 28-hour or a 30-hour work week.
You're right.
From going from 50
and if
to
I if I may
hours,
if I may
hasn't.
If I may interrupt you, Jeff, just because we only have a minute left here, let me just make this point real quickly. 1965, Time Magazine had a cover story. I've done a daily take on this before, a whole rant on this before, but it's worth revisiting. A cover story about the coming leisure society, and they were looking at those trends that you just identified, and they said if these trends continue. By the 90s, by the 80s and 90s, now this was in 1965, by the 80s and 90s, people will be working a 30-hour work week for the exact same take-home pay that they're getting right now. And the fact of the matter is that if the 1%, while wages since 1965 till today have been relatively flat for working people, they've gone up 273% for the top 1%. If the top 1% had not taken that money for themselves, if Mitt Romney had not taken that money for himself and had stayed with working people, we would have people working a 30-hour work week, and we would have the new leisure society that Time magazine was predicting. Jeff, you're absolutely right. Thank you very much for the call and making the point. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And by the way, that, you know, keeping an economy working in a way that it actually makes sure that working people get the fruit of their labors, that is a function of government.
Losing my mind, losing my mind, losing control. These fishes in the sea, they're staring at me.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Gwen in East Harlem, New York City. Hey, Gwen, what's up?
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Tom. Can you hear me?
I hear you just fine.
Well, first I wanted to tell you that I am so excited that I can see you on TV at Manhattan Neighborhood Network.
That's great.
I didn't know you were on.
Me too.
And I see your big fat cat because he looks like my tabby cat.
Yes. Yeah.
So I guess I wanted to tell you first, thank you for explaining redlining the best that anybody has ever explained it. Great. You must be a teacher somewhere in your life because you made that nice and easy. But, you know, I've been occupying Wall Street since it's open and have continued up till about the beginning of this month. But I am beginning to feel very disillusioned, not just because, well, there are so many things that make it difficult. For example, Mayor Bloomberg has armed guards in there that are paramilitary on Sunday when we go to meet. So we don't just have the regular police force going against us. We have people that are, you know, people that were in the Army. And as far as I understood, we have a civilian police force that we're supposed to have here, not paramilitary going after the people. But
well, I think you have a civilian police force that's dressed like stormtroopers, that's dressed like military.
I absolutely know this for a fact because
this is the U.S. Army?
Well, yes, the United States Army. What happened was, you know, we had been getting policemen in there, and we still do have policemen. Right. And then the uniforms changed. So I actually walked up to a couple of them, and I said, you know, you don't look like policemen to me. And he said, well, we're not. And I said, well, who are you? I said, you know, you look like you're in the military. He says, we are. He said, I just got back from Iraq. And he said, Mayor Bloomberg feels that we need to be here observing these groups. We are the paramilitary police force, and we're here to observe what you do.
I wonder National Guard, the New York State National Guard, because deployed to Iraq.
This were not National Guard. This is his words to me was, we are paramilitary. And he was one of the Marines. And I got into conversation with him because my husband, who's a postal worker, also was a Marine.
Yeah.
So we got talking on that level. And it's very, very uncomfortable to go there on Sundays because we're now inside of 60 Wall Street.
Right.
And, you know, these are groups of people that I work with, a group of, you know, it's a group called Occupy Department of Education now.
Right.
And, you know, we are regularly being observed and watched. But on just talking about Occupy Wall Street, what's really concerning me now is how the politicians and even the not-for-profits who really don't represent neighborhoods a lot of times. They represent keeping their little machine going, but they don't represent the people in our neighborhoods. We call them poverty pimps where I live. Mm-hmm. And it's getting to the point where I'm afraid that what started out with Occupy Wall Street, what was great, what I noticed, what was different, and I'm an activist for many, many years, what was different for me when I first went to Occupy was there really wasn't any leaders. It was a movement where everyone was getting to speak. Everybody had, it was great. I mean, people, every person there was getting to speak, and it didn't matter if you were from the homeless shelter or, you know, if you had a fur coat on. Everybody was getting to participate in the conversation about what is going on with our country and what we should do about it.
Mm.
But since it was crashed, you know, a couple months ago, it's begun changing. And more it's being used by bogus politicians. I mean, one of the politicians who is a multimillionaire herself, you know, claims to be somebody who is representing Occupy Wall Street. Well, excuse me, she's one of the people that rezoned the whole corridor of 125th Street in Harlem,
right,
which is emptying out and gentrifying Harlem as fast as, you know, we can speak. And it's
Gwen, this always happens.
To you.
I just have to say, this always happens. When you have any kind of a successful movement, you're going to have a lot of people who want to jump into it, including people with money.
Right.
I mean, you know, you've got Ben Cohen, for example, who has contributed some money to money to Occupy Wall Street. And some people are pushing back, and other people are saying, cool, let's take the money and do something good with it. These are the things that the movement has to sort out. And I'm not going to try to offer any advice about how to sort them out. But first of all, it's not my role to do that. And secondly, it wouldn't be, it wouldn't matter. But these are the things, and I think you and I both know this. These are the growing pains of a movement. These are actually, in many ways, a very healthy sign. And I would not despair about it or be upset about it. I think that, you know, the fact that people with money or people who have particular agendas or people who want to use Occupy Wall Street to promote their own thing, whatever, all the hanger-oners, all the promoters, the people who want to collaborate, the people who genuinely want to participate, the people, you know, everything, all that stuff happening, all of that is a sign that you guys are successful. And it's a sign, and the challenge that you have now is to figure out, do you want to be does Occupy Wall Street, does this group want to be a small, insular, exclusive group just unto itself, or does it want to integrate itself into the larger society? And if so, how? Because there's 100 different ways to do that, or 1,000 different ways to do that.
Right.
And some of those ways will involve diluting their influence, but on the other hand, because they become part of the, you know, instead of being a big frog in a little pond, they become a little frog in a bigger pond, but they might be a medium-sized frog in a bigger pond. And that's got to be the debate that's going on inside those halls right now, isn't it? How do we do this?
Well, there's a lot of in debating, infighting, clicks, a lot of discomfort, and a lot of people are feeling disappointed too, because I think at the beginning it was very refreshing. And
well,
I'll tell you something. I reluctantly went to Occupy Wall Street. I wanted to tell you something. You know, after the last 10 years of, you know, fighting against the war movement, I just gave up. I just said the hell with it. I'm not going to any more 2-hour, you know, petitions. I'm not doing that anymore.
And then,
it doesn't
but
make
then you
difference.
Check this out, and this was great. Gwen, we just have a minute to the end of the show here. I just have
all
to
right.
get this thought in. The order of the way that relationships happen is the same way that movements happen. First, people get together and they say, oh, look, you're just like me, and you find all the ways that you're identical. And that's the honeymoon. And then you start noticing, hey, wait a minute, you're different from me. And then you start finding all the differences. And that's when all the conflict emerges. And then if you get through those differences and work out the compromises and figure out, okay, you're different from me and here's how we can stay together, that's when you have true intimacy. That's when real love rather than romantic love happens. That's when real movements rather than just kind of flash mobs happen. And that's where Occupy Wall Street, in my opinion, is now. And Gwen, as I said, I think it's a good thing. Thank you for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So Fukushima happened a year ago Sunday, if my recollection of details and dates is correct, and I think it is, pretty sure it is. And David Lockbaum, the director of nuclear safety project at the UCS Global Security Program, a nuclear engineer. This is like that old joke, you know, where I used to have a friend who was a rocket scientist, literally, and down in Atlanta, and he had a T-shirt that said, "Yes, as a matter of fact, I am a rocket scientist." Okay, yes, as a matter of fact, he is a nuclear engineer and author of the report released today by the Union of Concerned Scientists, UCSUSA.org is the website. David Lockbaum. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me on. Appreciate it.
Thanks for joining us. You have been looking at the state of nuclear power and nuclear power plants in the United States and the lessons that we have learned from Fukushima. And presumably other disasters. There have been some minor ones here in the United States and major ones like Chernobyl and Fukushima. What is the assessment of the Union of Concerned Scientists, UCSUSA.org? What is your assessment of the current state of our nuclear power industry physically and environmentally and all that sort of thing?
Well, we're not much different
than the state was in Japan on March 10th of last year. We're protected unless a challenge comes up, severe challenge comes up. Then our reactors are as vulnerable as Fukushima was. The good news is that Fukushima didn't happen in the United States, bad for Japan, but if it's shame on us if we don't learn the lessons from that and take steps to reduce the vulnerabilities that exist in our reactors.
For example?
We failed to do that. For example, the biggest problem at Fukushima was an extended loss of power. Our reactor at Fukushima, they lost their normal source of power and the on-site backups.
And the reason that's important is?
All that power provides the energy for the pumps and the multitude of pumps. If you take away the power, you have a number of pumps that can't move water from point A to point B.
Which keeps
the
core cool.
They had a bunch of pumps and a lot of switches that keeps the core cool and then the spent
right.
fuel pool.
Right.
So they had a lot of electricity. They have a lot of pumps, but they couldn't run any of them. So they were left without options.
So,
in this country,
you know, I think a lot of people think that nuclear power plants create electricity, therefore they must generate their own electricity for those pumps. That's not the case.
That's not the case. The system that produces that electricity is not an emergency system. It's not a high-quality system. So in most events, it is not available.
So they're just pulling electricity off the grid kind of thing?
No, the grid's gone in most cases. What they do have is a number of diesel generators at the site that provide power. They had those at Fukushima, but the tsunami, they were in the basements, and the tsunami waters flooded them and disabled all of the emergency diesel generators.
Okay. So this...
our plants, while we're not susceptible to tsunamis for the most part, we are susceptible to fires. And we have roughly half the plants in the country don't meet fire protection regulations. So fire could take away the electricity that...
and isn't that what happened at Browns Ferry?
That's exactly what happened at Browns Ferry. And that was the reason the fire protection regulations were adopted. Oddly enough, Browns Ferry doesn't meet the regulations that were adopted because of its near miss.
Wow. Wow. That's incredible. So now I remember from around the time of Fukushima that there were floodwaters in, as I recall, Nebraska, and there were two nuclear power plants that were within a few feet of being flooded. Is that the sort of thing that you're talking about?
Exactly. Our plants are susceptible to acts of nature, whether it's flooding in Nebraska, as you pointed out last year, hurricanes in Florida, ice storms in the Midwest. Our plants, hurricanes down here in Tennessee where I am, our plants are vulnerable to those type of things. We need to make sure that if those bad days arrive, our plants are as robust as possible so they come out the other end as intact as possible and we don't have an American Fukushima.
I'm guessing, though, to bring a nuclear power plant up to that level of invulnerability would require a lot of money. And I lived in Vermont when Vermont Yankee was purchased by, Entergy, the company down in
Entergy,
down south?
That's correct, Entergy.
Yeah, and there was a lot of concern in the state about the fact that they wanted to drive the plant 20% harder than it had been and that it was designed for, I guess, if my recollection is correct. You please correct me if I'm wrong on any of these facts or details. And that they weren't going to put in a lot of money into the spent fuel pools, or they had no solution for the radioactive waste, and they weren't going to put in the kind of upgrades that the local nuclear engineers thought were necessary, because they're in business to make money. They're not in business to protect the public.
That is correct, but if you look at the cost of the Fukushima tragedy, that price tag would pay for all the safety upgrades at U.S. reactors.
Except we have Price Anderson, so we get stuck with it. I mean, we have this law that says that if a nuclear power plant goes down, then the taxpayers pay the bill, not the company that owns the nuclear power plant. So why should they bother investing money in upgrading their plants?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Price Anderson is an obstacle to safety rather than an enhancement. So we've advocated for years getting rid of that so plant owners would seek safety upgrades because they could recoup that in terms of reduced insurance premiums down the road.
But here's the problem. If my understanding of this is correct, and please correct me if I'm wrong, without Price Anderson and in Japan without the Japanese equivalent of Price Anderson, no rational insurance company, no insurance company out there, I mean, you know, right up to Lloyd's of London, will insure a nuclear power plant without a backup or a reinsurance plan that's provided by the government in case of a real catastrophic failure. So you couldn't have an operating nuclear power plant if you didn't have government subsidies.
That's true for today's reactors, but you could design a reactor that was safe enough that you could get private insurance. It would cost more, but the reduced safety and the annual insurance premiums over the life of the plant. Just like in my house, if I put in deadbolt locks and put in fire extinguishers, I get a break on my homeowner's insurance that more than pays for those features.
Right.
The nuclear industry is getting a free ride. They get the benefits of the electricity they produce, but they don't have to pay for the potential consequences. We pick that up, and that's just risk-reward is perverse.
Right, through Price-Anderson. So the 105 or thereabouts, 104, how many nuclear reactors are operating in the United States?
104 reactors.
104, okay. Of those reactors, how many of them could be easily shifted to this kind of, you know, safe enough to be privately insured technology, or are you talking about just building new ones from scratch?
We were mainly talking about the new reactors because it's difficult to wave a magic wand and fix the sins of the past. But that doesn't mean we continue building more sins in the future. We should learn from that and make tomorrow's reactors safer. But the two reactors that the NRC recently approved in Georgia are not that much better from a safety standpoint than the reactors that we've built in the past.
How many reactors do we have in the United States that are basically the same design, the General Electric Mark II, was it, boiling water reactor that Fukushima, that several of the Fukushima plants were?
Yeah, there were 35 reactors similar to Fukushima. There's 30 of those that are almost identical to the Fukushima reactors. The other 69 reactors are pressurized water reactors. But to be honest, it's no gig against General Electric. Had any of the pressurized water reactors faced that 1-2 punch, the timeline might have been different, but the outcome would have been likely the same disaster.
How many people in the United States are at risk from the nuclear reactors we have?
Hundreds of millions. It's like you said it earlier on with the NRDC report, it's about half the Americans living in the country live within 50 miles of a nuclear power plant. So there's quite a few people in jeopardy, and unfortunately, all of them are at undue jeopardy because we know of ways to make them safer. We just choose not to.
We choose to not force the industry to do so.
The biggest problem is not the Nuclear Regulatory Commission per se. It's the Congress, which sets the NRC's budget. So whoever controls your budget and your purse strings pretty much controls what you do and how you do it. Years ago, in 1998, the Congress threatened to cut the NRC's budget by 40%. If they just didn't, unless they stopped enforcing regulations. The NRC heard that, listened very well, and they pretty much stopped enforcing regulations.
Oh, amazing.
Took their jobs.
Amazing. David Lochbaum, you can read all about it, a Union of Concerned Scientists, UCSUSA.org. David, thank you.
Thank you, Tom. Appreciate it.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Fukushima in America. I don't even want to think about it. I mean, this is horror beyond imagination. And yet we almost lost Detroit with Fermi.
Go nuclear.
Couple of quick announcements. Number one, leave a comment on our Facebook page. You could receive an autographed copy of one of my books. We're going to be starting giving away a book every single day here shortly. And secondly, Heist the Movie. It's running through this Thursday. Hopefully it'll stay longer than that in New York City. If you're listening to us on WWRL or on Sirius or XM or Manhattan Neighborhood Networks or Free Speech TV, Dish Network, DirecTV, whatever it may be, however you're hearing this, if you're in New York, get thee down to the Quad Cinema, 34 West 13th Street in New York City. This is just an incredible movie, and I know because I narrated it, and I volunteered my services. This is not a paid announcement. I just think this is really cool, and it's a great movie. You can learn more about it. The website is heist-themovie.com. And the movie features Bernie Sanders, Robert Kuttner, David K. Johnston, Nomi Prinz, Van Jones, and more. It is just super. Carrie in Pipe Creek, Texas. Hey, Carrie, what's up?
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Good.
Just a quick mention about Fukushima. The company that was responsible for installing the backup diesel generators. For those generators weren't even designed for that purpose. In fact, the failures during startup was 100% because those engines have to be warmed up.
Right. Which is normal with large diesel engines.
Yeah, it usually takes 30 minutes. All the details are I think it's Greg Palast in Vulcan's Picnic.
Yep.
But it's appalling.
Yeah, we've had Greg on the program about this. And Go ahead.
Is in the United States that they're going to do. I mean, with our nuclear power plants, they're probably the same company is probably going to install the same window dressing as they did in Japan.
Yeah, we need to all keep an eye on this. Kerry, thanks a lot for the call. And you're right, it was Greg Palast. As I said, he's talked about that on this program. And anyhow, Michael, listening on KVOT in Taos, New Mexico. Hey, Michael, what's on your mind?
Top of the day, Tom. I'm here thanking you and your wonderful, mostly lucid callers in regard to sharing your lives with me and what's happening in my country. I would like you to develop Tom's top 10 list of what I could do to be a better citizen of this beautiful country, such as maybe anything from brushing your teeth every day to knowing your neighbor.
Michael, there's the thank you for the call and thank you for asking the question. How do we become better citizens? How do we become better people? Two thoughts come immediately to mind. Politically speaking, get involved in movement politics. Join a local group. Participate in something that is local and that is active where people are showing up, whether it's Progressive Democrats of America, PDAmerica.org, or democracyforamerica.com, or one of the other great groups. Ben and Jerry have a movement, progressivemajority.org, it's called. There are others. There's a bunch of great organizations out there, number one. Secondly, and I haven't talked about this in a long time, and I think that this is really worth just dropping into your brain for a moment to think about. In the 1950s, and I don't know when they ended it. One of these days I've got to do the research on this and find out. But in the 1950s, as I recall, the Boy Scout motto or the Boy Scout commission, what you had to do, and maybe this was true of Girl Scouts too. I wasn't a girl. But as a Boy Scout, you had to do a good deed every day. And they had a very specific definition of good deed. A good deed is something that benefits somebody else, and they don't know that you did it. And I can tell you from personal experience, those are really hard to find. It's really hard to find an opportunity, even once every 24 hours, to do something for somebody else where they don't know that you did it. But I can tell you, it is very satisfying. So, I'll just this is a more of a religious example, but at Herr Mueller, Mr. Mueller was the founder of the Salem International Organization. In fact, I'll be doing my show from Germany in a couple of weeks. Every year I go back. Now, he died a couple of years ago at the age of 94, and we have a memorial service for him every year. You can read all about it over at saleminternational.org. And at his first funeral, Gerhard Liefert's wife, she runs one of the solemn villages in Hirchheim on what used to be the old East German border. She told the story of how Herr Mueller had suggested to her, what she said, what can I do? And he said, every person you see, send them a blessing. And so she just started this practice of every person that she saw, she would just look at them and in her mind she would say, you know, God bless you, or I bless you, or, you know, may you be well, or something. You should send them, you know, some good vibes, some light, whatever your frame is. And she told the story of how this changed her life. And I thought it was just a beautiful and elegant story and, you know, something to think about. So anyhow, Carol in Charlottesville, Virginia. Hey, Carol, what's up?
Hi, Tom. My son is a scientist at Los Alamos National Labs, and they're not concerned about Iran getting the bomb, but they're very concerned about Iran's reactor because the designs they've seen for it indicate that it is probably going to have a core meltdown as soon as it's operational. They have been begging to help the Iranians, you know, do their design and bring it on without catastrophe.
Right.
Israel should be more worried about that nuclear reactor than they are about Iran getting a bomb.
Yeah, that's all we need is a Fukushima in the center of the Middle East.
Yeah, and the scientists there are very, very concerned.
Yeah. Carol, thank you very much for that. I it hadn't occurred to me, but it makes perfect sense. I mean, the Iranians are all running around going, oh, we're not trying to build a bomb. We're just trying to enrich uranium for our reactors. And so far, according to all 16 U.S. intelligence agencies, that's true. Which begs the question, are your reactors any good? Yikes. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Back with the good, the bad, and the incredibly ugly in your calls after this. Be the good, the bad, and the very, very auto-shediastically ugly, the good. Alabama State Rep. Daniel Bowman. Bowman introduced a resolution in Alabama's House that mocks Republican-backed job creation efforts in the state. The resolution jokes that scientists will soon grow money on trees and goes on to claim that large class sizes in school are good for students seeking to make more friends. It also argues that Alabama's children should be helping our economy by working and not learning useless skills like reading, writing, and arithmetic that are completely unessential in today's economy. When conservatives introduce legislation that does nothing to help society, sometimes you just have to laugh it off and make some fun out of it. Good on you, Representative Bowman. The bad. Ann Romney. The wife of presidential candidate Mitt Romney was asked by Fox News' Neil Cavuto yesterday about her family's reputation as being out of touch with the majority of Americans. In attempting to answer the question, Romney only helped to further the stigma towards her and her husband. She told Cavuto this.
We can be poor in spirit. And I don't even consider myself wealthy.
I wonder how you struggle to pay your bills in spirit or have nightmares about losing your home in spirit. It really is scary how out of touch Mrs. Romney and her husband are with the people that they hope to become to be leading come November. The very, very ugly Pat Robertson. The television evangelist added his two cents yesterday on why a string of tornadoes ravaged the Midwest last Friday. On his program, The 700 Club, Robertson asked why people would knowingly live in tornado-prone areas to begin with. He then blamed a lack of prayer for the devastating tornadoes, saying, if enough people were to pray, God would intervene. You could pray. Jesus stilled the storm. You could still storms. Rather than discuss ways to help and support those whose lives were destroyed by the tornadoes, Robertson chose to add fuel to the fire, and that is very, very ugly. Amazing. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. Joyce in Arcadia, California, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Joyce, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. I hope the same is true of you.
I love that when you say that. I'm great, but I'll get better. You may remember me. I'm the lady who called you several weeks ago with the metaphor of we're all teeth in the same mouth. You loved it.
Sure.
Well, I wanted to talk to you about this nuclear power situation.
Mm-hmm.
I worked at Detroit Edison from 1962 to 1992.
Oh, you were there when we almost lost Detroit, when Fermi almost went down.
Yeah, Fermi, Enrico Fermi Power Plant. And as an employee, I was a stenographer there. And we toured the place or whatever, but naturally they didn't tell us anything about the dangers involved. Mm-hmm. Now, what I don't understand is the people who build, operate, own, and whatever these plants, they breathe the same air as everyone else. And if there is a disaster, and I think that this is a disaster just waiting to happen, while I was on hold, you were listing off some of the things about nuclear power and that the plants are operating above what they were designed to. They're old and all this other stuff. So it's just an accident waiting to happen. What do we have to do to get rid of nuclear power? And not only that, but isn't the radiation or the byproduct, the waste, radioactive for 1,000 years or something like that?
In some cases, 1,000,000 years. Yeah. Plutonium
what?
And some of the other radionuclides. All
That's
the,
unimaginable, Tom.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. And what I think it's going to take is probably some horrible accident in the United States for Americans to really and genuinely wake up. Three Mile Island, which was bad enough, but it wasn't anything like Chernobyl or Fukushima, basically caused a 20-year pause in the construction of nuclear power plants in the United States. Now the NRC has just authorized the construction of two of them down in Georgia, and they've begun construction. And, you know,
no.
It's just, Yeah, it's insane. It is totally insane.
But it's
insane.
All based on ignorance.
I know.
People, you know, when I was touring that plant, I had no idea. I didn't even know what nuclear power was.
Right.
Still don't, for that matter.
Well, and most Americans don't.
I just know that it's dangerous.
Yeah, most Americans don't. And most Americans don't understand it. Most Americans don't know that there is no solution to the nuclear waste disposal problem. There is that these plants have pools next to them that have to be kept cool with circulating pumps that require external electricity, and that in those pools are decades, in some cases, worth of nuclear waste, that they are not protected by giant containment vessels like the reactors themselves are. And so if, you know, God forbid, some terrorist was to fly a plane into one of them or blow them up somehow, you know, you'd have the world's biggest dirty bomb. And, you know, they're not going to melt down, but they're going to spray radiation all over the place. That the reactors are the same designs as the one in Fukushima. You know, people just don't get this. And Joyce, we need to tell them. You need to tell people about the Union of Concerned Scientists, UCS.USA or UCSUSA.org, and spread the word.
What was that again?
Union of Concerned Scientists. So it's UCS.
Union of Concerned Scientists.
Right. And so their website is UCS, as in Union of Concerned Scientists, and then followed by USA.org. UCSUSA.org.
UCS.USA.org.
No, you got an extra dot in there. UCSUSA.org.
Oh, I see. UCSUSA.org.
Yeah, check it out. It's amazing.
We've got to educate people.
There you go.
This is ridiculous.
There you go. We've got to wake them up. Thanks a lot, Joyce. I appreciate it. By the way, Limbaugh, today, so far on his show anyway, he still has another 20 minutes to go. So far, he has not blown up on this young woman, this young Georgetown law student. But he did, I think, you know, he's talking about the government, but I think this is meta. This is a giant Freudian slip. Here it is.
It has to be the best. It has to be the most expensive, but it has to be practically given away. Otherwise, what? Walmart is racist. That's how this works. This is how pressure is brought to bear on people in the private sector. Schism of racism, discrimination, servicing only a few small percentage points of the market, force them to cave to the all-powerful demands of the federal government, because to do otherwise is to incur their wrath, and nobody wants that. What is it with all of these young, single white women, overeducated? Doesn't mean intelligent.
Oh, yeah. These young, single white women, overeducated. Where'd that come from? Oh, that's right. You're going after a college student who's in graduate school. Stephen in Beulah, Colorado, listening on Sirius. Hey, Stephen, what's up?
Hey, good talking to you, Mr. Hartman. Enjoy your show and
your
books especially.
Thank you.
Listen, on this poor young woman who was defamed by Mr. Limbaugh, when I first heard what he had to say, I had to go outside and scream. I'm a retired trial lawyer, and I've had the privilege of working with some very fine trial lawyers throughout my career. And while, you know, the good ones that are still in practice won't be listening to this program, I'm sure the word will get out about this woman's situation. First of all, what he had to say, this is what's called defamation per se. He has accused this woman of criminal conduct, being a prostitute. And in cases like that, you don't have to prove damages. Now, the exception is if she's a public figure. Well, heck, she wasn't a public figure until Limbaugh made her one.
Well, I think don't you think that his attorneys would argue that she became a public figure by testifying before Nancy Pelosi in Congress?
Well, that would mean that there are tens of thousands of people across the country that automatically become public figures as soon as they step in front of a microphone in the State House.
Right.
I don't think New York Times versus Sullivan is that broad. And anyway, the main thing is that I'd hate to, there's certainly going to be a lawsuit, but I'd hate to see it settled. You know, your previous speaker on there, Lori Peterson, I think her name was, she said, oh, I'd love to get him in a deposition. No. I'd love to get him in a federal courtroom sweating through his jacket in front of a jury of six citizens.
Yeah, there you go.
And I certainly hope this case is not settled. It should go to trial, because if it's settled, we'll never know the details, because those are always conditions of any settlement.
Yeah.
Somebody, some good lawyer, I used to work for Melvin Belli, one of the finest trial lawyers in the world, and he'd never settle a case like this. It would go to trial.
Yeah.
And because she is a law student, she understands how all this works, and it would go up on appeal. for sure. I don't know if it would go to the Supreme Court, but it would go to whatever circuit court's involved.
Yeah. Well, it all depends on how far Limbaugh wants to fight it and whether he loses at each stage along the way or either party, actually, loses and decides to appeal it to a higher court. Stephen, thank you for the call. Excellent point. And Susan in Los Angeles. Hey, Susan, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. I called in. I didn't know if you had gotten the word last night. The Lakota Indians were trying to stop trucks from coming in with parts for the Keystone XL pipeline. They were arrested. The drivers told the Lakotas and the officers, "You can't stop us. We have corporate rights that supersede all other laws."
Whoa.
I thought that was pretty outrageous, and I thought you should know about it.
Yeah. Well, I know down in Texas there have been 20-some-odd cases where the Keystone XL, TransCanada, actually, it's a Canadian corporation, has claimed eminent domain under the Fifth Amendment of the United States, that they've gone in and they've taken property from private homeowners and ranchers saying, we now own your property by virtue of the power of the federal government, and, we're just taking it, and that there's one woman who is fighting them in court, and we'll see where this one goes. But the Keystone Pipeline is already under construction in the United States, and which blows my mind because, to the best of my knowledge, the president has not authorized a permit for it. So how are they using eminent domain? Thank you, Susan, for that. The information I had was about Texas. Lakota would be up in North Dakota, right? South Dakota?
Right, and they're trying to stop them from coming in from Canada.
Yeah, amazing. On the northern border. Susan, thank you very much, and thanks for listening to us there in L.A. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We're going to check in with the Talk Radio News Service, find out what's going on in the world today after this. Stick around. Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here with big news. We're moving. Starting next week, the Tom Hartman Program will be live 3 to 6 p.m. Eastern Time. That's noon to 3 Pacific Time.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the files of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by Ellen Ratner's new book, Self-Empowerment. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
I see you are at the White House, and I understand that President Obama had just one incredible press conference this morning.
He gave an extremely strong defense of any policy that you happen to throw at him. He threw it right back at you, starting, of course, with Iran, which he was asked about by no fewer than, I believe, three different reporters. And he talked about the Iran-Israel policy and the policy of no containment and not allowing Iran to get a nuclear weapon. And then he said, and I'm looking down because I'm looking at the notes I made on my laptop, he talked about, he said something, that is my track record. Then he just said, what is said on the campaign trail, those folks don't have a lot of responsibility. They're not commander-in-chief. And then he just went on. When I see the casualness with which those folks talk about war, I'm reminded of the costs of war, the decisions I have to make in terms of sending our young men and women into battle, in terms of the impact on lives and the economy. And he went on. He said, it's not a game. There's nothing casual about it. When I see folks talk a lot of bluster and big talk, but when I ask them, when you ask them specifically what they would do, it turns out they repeat things we've been doing for the last 3 years. He said, one thing we've not done is launch a war. If some of these folks think we should launch a war, they should say so and tell the American people why. Everything else is just talk.
He's calling out the chicken hawks.
He is.
You know, like Gingrich and whatnot. This is the Bomberan folks. I understand also somebody asked him, I think it was a Fox News reporter, why do you want higher gasoline prices?
Yes, yes. Ed Henry asked him about that, asked him about gasoline prices. And he said, from a political perspective, You think the President of the United States wants gas prices to go higher? You think that makes sense going into an election?
The bottom line is
I want them lower because they hurt families.
Yeah, well, good. And he also referenced the whole Rush Limbaugh thing.
He did. He was asked a question about the Rush Limbaugh thing, and then a whole load of reporters started shouting out questions, all of which he ignored. He said that he didn't know what was in Rush Limbaugh's heart, so he couldn't speak on the sincerity of the apology, and he said he was not going to comment on sponsors or the economics or the politics of the issue. But he said he could comment on all decent folks can agree that remarks that were made don't have any place in public discourse. And he said that the reason he called Sandra Fluke was that he thought about Malia and Sasha.
He thought about his own two daughters.
Yeah, and one of the things he said I want them to do when they're older is engage in issues they care about and be able to speak their mind in a civil, thoughtful way, and he doesn't want them attacked or called horrible names because they're being good citizens.
That's essentially the same thing that David Friend, the CEO of Carbonite, said when he talked about why he was pulling his ads, because he invented the product in the first place for his college-age daughter, and he was pretty horrified, I guess.
I believe 25 people have now pulled out.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing.
So it was a very, very interesting press conference. He was asked about whether there is, in fact, a war on women. He said that women are going to make up their own mind in the election about who is advancing the issues they care most deeply about. And he said that I've learned that I don't tell Michelle what she thinks is important, and that women are not one-issue voters, and they never have been, and they will decide. But he thinks that the Democrats have the better case.
Yeah, I think that's very much the case. And every time Rick Santorum opens his mouth, his foot gets deeper in it.
Seems to be the case.
Yeah. Any blowback or any issues brought up about Ann Romney saying that she's not rich and she could lose it all any minute?
It's sort of one of those stories that's going around Washington, sort of like, you know, is this a family, this family illness?
Yeah.
You know, like an infection. One of them gets it.
Do you know? Mitt, of course, was born a multimillionaire, like George W. Bush was. You know, big, rich family. Was Anne? Do you know?
I don't know whether she was or whether she wasn't. I have seen the full context of her remarks, and it was in the context of talking about her illness and how much she cares about other people. In the context of that money wasn't important to her, but.
Well, that's a much more reasonable context. I mean, this is a woman with MS, and so she literally could lose everything. She could lose her life.
Right.
Okay.
She could. So
well, that moderates it considerably.
It was moderated, but nevertheless, it was a completely tone deaf.
Yeah, to say I don't think of myself as wealthy. Yeah.
That was tone deaf.
Yeah, I think it was tone deaf.
The only other thing I would mention very briefly to you is that the Senate transportation bill should come up for a vote today. I say should because you never know with these things. Harry Reid wants to bring it up without amendments because it's become a bit of a Christmas tree. The contraception vote last week was an amendment to the transportation bill. I know, that's weird.
Yeah.
John Boehner in the House said today that they might take up the Senate bill. And the only reason he's doing that is because his own signature transportation bill failed utterly. And they have no transportation bill. And transportation funding runs out on March the 31st. And that's when potholes cease to be filled and roads don't get fixed and construction projects grind to a halt.
And the Republicans don't want to take the blame for that.
No.
Yeah. Very, very interesting. And great that it's the Democratic bill that's going to get pushed through. We'll see how it goes. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Great having you with us. And coming up tomorrow, of course, we're going to have all the news and the results from the Super Tuesday elections that are happening around the country tonight. And I'll be challenging Jacob Sullum of Reason Magazine about hate crime laws. Are they thought crimes? Is there such a thing? And of course, all the other news of the day. Don't forget, democracy begins when you get active, when you show up, when you participate. Tag, you're it. Occupy something. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.